So as all of you are students studying different subjects, and it is very important to have wisdom and intelligence which distinguishes right from wrong. And you need to develop not just wisdom or an understanding drawn through study or hearing the teachings, but you need to actually reflect on whatever you have studied and develop the wisdom or understanding drawn through understanding through contemplation. And so, in order to develop, have right kind of wisdom, that kind of wisdom, we have the practices based on deities such as Manjushri. And in our practice, we find mention of remembering the deities and so forth. And also in the archaeological findings, when people dig the grounds for ancient ruins, of monasteries and so forth, people have also found statues and images of Tara and Avalokiteshvara and so forth. So in the past, many of the Indian masters have relied on Manjushri for gaining wisdom, and also many of the masters of the Tibetan Buddhist traditions have done so. And so, regarding myself personally, I have recited the praise of Manjushri Kangloma, and also done different practices according to different Tibetan Buddhist traditions. And I have, through these practices, I can tell that in relation to Manjushri really helps to develop wisdom. And so I thought of doing a blessing of Manjushri today, and there are many different kinds of Manjushri practice according to different tantric classes of tantra. And so one of the most a concise practice of Manjushri is Kangloma. So I, in order to give this blessing to you, I will first go through the preliminary ritual to prepare for this blessing initiation.
Text and put words and treatises on them.
Rajomba Yantaba Zobe Sanya praise to the Buddha. Yankamba Kebo Dube Kalo Juwa Lana Mebal Hadam Minam Getumba Sanje Chum Den Depe Yawa Shaja Toba La Chats Chodo Jabso Chio Tumba Chum Den De Shin Shekwa Drajo Zobe Sanje Rigwa Dan Shabso Demba Devore Shekwa Chik Den Kemba Kebo Dube Kalo Juwa Lana Mebal Hadam Minam Getumba Sanje Benjo, I shall ya to Bala Chatel or Chendo, I jumps on Chio and Timbaj. So, Besson, Yeriba, Dunsham, so Demba, they were a ship watching, then Jamba, Jabo, they were called Jua, Lana, Mabal, Hadami. Chumden, the Beja, Washa, Yato, Walla, Chata, Locho, do Jepso, Chioji. Jetum, this Ochin, De La Comba, Dumbo, Nangan, and Jig, then Dena, Choches, on Tetse, Keba, Jola. Namda Gonga, Choto, Susan, why is she just a sick, and Humbo, Tata, Wachi, then some Nana. Composure nature, large answer, lots and joy, then bottom and the wish, the daughter, what you watch. The take and rusty boss so much in your making, jinky, large answer, look, and bottle chitch, then bottom chicken bed. So, no mean, then get you in the shin shell, large answer, lot of bed, the chart. Give against one letter, shin shell, don't turn them choking, but she do chill large. Turn the travel lion, turn la bata, la rabdonation, get on by, and then they get in lion, chatter, lot, they watch him. Yawapen son so varje ranje semne yon so de dine sanje temba yin kamara rem. Gyumasi ba chubur tan min lam lo tan jinda po duje chenam didar ta suenam diye tamje sikba yi kopan tomne genge. Gada nada chewe lop chobe sibe chole cho andre war shu. This is homage to the mother of all Buddhas, the perfection of wisdom. Paragate para, the mantra of Heart Sutra. Dayata gate gate para gate para sangha de bodhi swaha. Dayata gate gate para gate para sangha de bodhi swaha. Verse of salutation from Abhisamaya Alamkara of Maitreya. Namba kundena zo tisong ba nyen de chan ju sembe zo che sanje ki ni yum de ro cha. Verse of salutation from Master Nagarjuna's Mula Madhyama Kakarika, the fundamental stanzas of the middle way. Ta te alo. So his holiness is performing the ritual to drive away in the evil forces who might otherwise hinder the blessing ceremony of Manjushri, the Buddha of wisdom. So for this, the ritual of offering torma is being performed. So when I travel, when I meet people around the world, I usually tell that we are now in the 21st century. So the 20th century was our century of my generation. So people who are in their 60s and 70s and above belong to the 20th century. Now people who are children who are 15 or below, or 20 or 30, below 30, we can consider you to be the people, the generation of the 21st century. So 20th century is gone. Now the past century, the 20th century, our century, was such that when I was born in 1935, when I was born,
in China, the Sino-Japanese War was about to begin, and then soon after that, the Second World War happened and occurred, and then the Nazi influence was spreading. And then in 1938-39, the Second World War happened. So from about 1939 to 45, the Second World War occurred, and so many people were killed. And in China itself, there's been lots of civil wars, and many people were killed, and also in the Korean War, many people were killed. So during those wars in Japan and China, people were inconsiderate to the life of other human beings. Of course, America also supported by supplying weapons. So there was a wave of military soldiers were sent to fight against the other group. And then there was the Vietnamese War. Again, so many were killed and injured. And then, during the 21st century, there was the Afghan war, the crisis in Afghanistan and Iraq, also Japan. And so these are due to the people's way of thinking that we must resort to violence in order to win against our adversaries. And so there was such thinking and habit in people's minds in the 20th century. So therefore lots of wars and battles happened in different parts of the world, in regions of the world. So such immense destruction and violence, if they had actually brought more peace and happiness in the world, then as a result of the violence, then we could perhaps say the wars were justified. But this was not the case. And so even today we experience the symptoms of those violence in this century. So happiness in the world cannot be achieved through war and violence. In the past, different nations and different regions remained rather isolated, independent from each other, without having to depend on others. And therefore, people rather lived isolated. And in those days, perhaps we could talk about winning on for victory for one side and defeat for the other. But today, this is not the case. So the whole world is globalized. And even the national boundaries and economic boundaries, environmental boundaries are... there is no such boundaries. And therefore, there's no... making such demarcations as we and they is something outdated. So war happened when we make such distinct demarcations between one's own side and others. So So if we need to, if we still hang on to such division that in us and they, then it's no use. Even when, as an individual, if your leg is hurt, you need to use your hands to help it. And so we need to consider all the 7 billion people in this world. As one, and so we should live as one entity, whether we are happy or in sorrow, we must live as one. And so it is rather a drawback to think that our problems should be overcome through weapons. And so during the time of Saddam Hussein, I received some letters from different people and asked me to, they suggested if I could, for me to go to Iraq and talk with Saddam Hussein by meeting him. So I don't know, I did not have any contact in Iraq, and if I went there without knowing anybody, I would suffer to the point that I might not get even a cup of tea, and so I won't be able to help. So I also said that if representatives from the UN or the European Union went there, Saddam Hussein might be more suspicious about them. But people who have no such contact with the government or anything, such as scientists or philosophers and thinkers, so not representing any country or any organization, but people who are dedicated and sincere to have a dialogue and talk with Saddam Hussein. So I suggested that such people should go, because once the war starts, then Saddam Hussein would lose, and so nobody would be actually gain anything. And so I had this thought that perhaps the Iraqi the war in Iraq could have been prevented. So people who have no political affiliation, but who are actually principled, I suggested that if such people could go to there, I suggested to the late Vaclav Havel of Czech Republic, when it was Czechoslovakia at the time. I also talked with de Klerk from South Africa, the president of South Africa at the time. I also was there in a meeting, and also in Czech Republic there is Forum 2000. I suggested to start from there to have somebody to talk with Saddam Hussein. So now, today, the situation in the world has changed in Europe or America or in Asia, and even China, the things have changed. So people are becoming aware that violence is not the solution to problems. And therefore, we need to make the 21st century a century of nonviolence, century of peace. And of course, there will be problems, but we should solve those problems and difficulties through dialogue and by talk. And so I suggest this century, 21st century, should be a century of dialogues or a century of peace and nonviolence. I usually suggest. So in order to have dialogue, of course, which is for mutual benefit, we need to respect others. We need to be compassionate with others. with a strong feeling of victory for oneself and defeat for the other party. You cannot have respect for others. And therefore, in order to have mutual benefit, we need to have respect and love towards others. So, in order to build a non-violent world, a peaceful world in this 21st century, to be a century of peace and non-violence, we need to cultivate compassion, develop compassion. So I always say that whenever I meet people, I tell them that I don't consider myself as being a Buddhist and try to make some kind of a demarcation between me and others. And if I also think that I'm a Tibetan, and also if I'm the Dalai Lama, I'll make this gap, create a gap between them and others. So I always told them that emotionally, mentally, and physically, we are the same. I always tell people. And so all of us are part of the 7 billion people on this earth. So if the 7 billion people are happy, then the individuals will be happy. And if 7 billion people suffer through abuse, exploitation, and war and so forth, then individuals also will suffer. And so in China, the greater the practice of compassion and love, not just in words, but in practice, then the Tibetan problem would be resolved. And therefore, we need to think about coexistence and friendship and harmony, and not think about defeat for others and victory for oneself. I always tell people that we cannot resolve the problems by by thinking and by considering ourselves and others to be enemies, and some as enemies and others as our friends. And so many people appreciate these. And so Tibetans are also part of the 7 billion people of the world. And now you, the younger generation, are the generation of the 21st century. So my generation, the generation of the 20th century, will be no more there no more in 15, 20 years. And so, as you grow up, you will have to shoulder the responsibility. We usually to make this prayer: may all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. So practically, if you are able to help others by taking responsibility to help others, that would be practical. So otherwise, by praying and doing such, making such prayer, and being rather in practice being selfish is a lie, and so it's a hypocrisy. So we are part of the 7 billion people, and Tibetans particularly, you are the 21st century Tibetans. So how then the future will be, the future century will be, then it's in your hands. So for the 21st century Tibet to be good, of course, we need material development, which is important, but mainly we need internal development, within our mind. So the world is not bereft of material development, but bereft of moral principles. And so, just as we say, we must look at the harvest, the good harvest of the neighbors. We need to inculcate these moral principles within ourselves and practice love and compassion, not only to human beings, but in accordance with Buddhism, to all sentient beings. We need not say that, oh, this is because of what the Buddha has said, but if you actually relate to your own life, you will be able to see how the negative emotions like our anger and so forth are destructive, and how the love and compassion are have positive impact in our life. Even medical scientists, practitioners say that. And so the practice of love and compassion is helpful even to our physical health, and therefore we need to use different reasons to find conviction in the practice of love and compassion. I saw one article written by an American scientist in which he's written that those who tell lies have lots of stress in their mind. So, with regard to telling lie, when I was with working with the Chinese before 1959, and I had to practice lie. And so, in time, they were suspicious of me, and they always carried guns in their pockets. So, even though deep down I was not well, I was not feeling good, but I had to say, hang hao, I'm very good, very good. And so you always, if you tell lies, you would always have to be apprehensive whether somebody would actually catch you amongst you as students. If you tell lie a lot, then you would always have to be apprehensive that somebody might find out about your motive. So, of course, you may be angry with each other, but then you should get rid of that and be friendly with others later. So you should not hold grudge and at others and have kind of ulterior motive while you smile at them. So after 59, I always tell people that I was liberated from hypocrisy and lying. So I honestly, sincerely feel that we are all same, whether I'm talking to one person or a thousand or 10,000 and so forth. I do not make any preparation as to what I should say and so forth. And so I'm being very frank with people. And when I do this, I'm happier. So otherwise, if I consider myself to be very important and sacred and holy and so forth, then there I would have more kind of stress and anxiety, and which builds up stress. So if I'm honest and sincere with others, then I do not have to feel anxiety and fear. And so I do not feel, then if I, through this, it helps not to feel tired easily. So when I meet Chinese or some Westerners who are more serious and remain solemn, and to stay with them even a few minutes makes me feel tired. But when I am able to talk frankly and on a human level, then it's different. Like the American President Bush Jr., I find him to be very an open person and transparent. And then there are other leaders who are very formal, who like formality a lot. And so when I'm with people who are more relaxed and could talk to them on a human level, then I feel very much at ease, even if I spend 1 hour or so. And so you should be transparent without having any suspicion, and because through that you will have trust, build trust with them, And then you'll be able to talk to them honestly. And if you are, if you try to be very devious and immoral, then people will not like you. Even dogs and cats do not like if you are not good to them. And so being moral is not about religion. It has nothing to do with religion as such. But if you are moral and if you are principled, then you will have friends. You will be friendly with others, and you have friends with others. So you live in a society, so as a social animal, and therefore your happiness is dependent on others. And if you have to live in suspicion with others, then you won't have happiness. So when Mao Zedong in the beginning was very good, he was very dedicated for the welfare of the working class. So in 1954 and 55, I was in Beijing, and so for a few months I was touring around China, and I really admired, felt admiration for socialism, which is a socialism which is dedicated and for the welfare of the others. And capitalism is only for individual profit. So then I said I was going to join the Communist Party. And I said, they told the leaders, Chinese leaders told me that there's no hurry yet, you can take time. And so I later tell people that at that time the communist leaders of China had some clairvoyance that the communist party, the communism in China would be ruined and spoiled in the end. So, but in the beginning, initially, communism was dedicated to socialism, in China was dedicated for the welfare of the working class. But then it degenerated, and then the leaders focused on one's own power, authority, one's economy, and benefits. And then socialism got, the communism was spoiled. So the true communism is concerned. So I say that as far as socialism economic theory is concerned, I'm Marxist, I should say. And so you should be very kind and be moral. That would be beneficial to you as individuals, and it will also be good for the Tibetan cause. And since the spread of Buddhism in Tibet and the practice of love and compassion spread in the Tibetan society, we have this practice of avoiding non-virtuous actions such as killing even insects, even children have this basic habit of considering such actions as being unwholesome. And so we Tibetans, I always say that the Tibetan culture is a culture of compassion, and therefore it is a culture of nonviolence. And therefore, on this, we can actually show example to the world, and we can make contribution to the world. And therefore, if you live a good life, you will be serving the Tibetan people, and also you'll be able to show the Tibetan moral principles. Principle, and so this can be a role model for the rest of the world. During one of the during one of the meetings of the education department of the CTA, we discussed about teaching the logical dialectical debate to the students. And I said that we discussed that, said that we could make a great contribution to the world at large through this study. And at one of the Mind and Life conferences, one scientist said that you have this tradition of teaching the different subjects that are studied in the monastic institutions through debate, dialectical debate, and could that not be taken or used or applied in other subjects? So he was a scientist, and he had such an interest. And then in Drepung, there were about 10 ten scientists, and one of the scientists was who had not been in the Mind and Life conference, but was also there. So he was from the west coast of America. So during when they were there in Drepung, the monks of the monastic institutions of Sera Drepung Garden were having a debate, inter-monastic debate called Jayang Gunchu. And so the scientists were able to witness that, and they found that the dialectical debate that is used examine the different topics through debate in the debate in courtyards was quite admirable. They found so they were really happy and appreciate what they saw in the debate courtyards of the monastic institutions, and so. This tall scientist during our Mind and Life conference actually, and he even used the clapping that is used by the monks in their debate. So he really got into this debate in their discussions. And then I have met some Chinese and a historian whom I've met several times. And so I met this person in Dharamsala. And then this person also went to South India. And so having witnessed how the monks studied, and this person had said that what the Dalai Lama says that the Tibetan Buddhist tradition is a pure and authentic lineage of Nalanda tradition, he could witness how the Tibetans actually preserved the pure authentic Nalanda tradition for over 1,000 years. At that time. And then these people are also amazed to know that the monks spent 20, 30 years to become geishas. And then people from the Himalayan regions like Ladakh and Mon and so forth also study 20 to 30 years, spend 20 to 30 years in their studies and become geishas. And so the scholars who are impartial take interest in this kind of debate, study, procedure of their study. And so everything that we study are done in Tibetan, our own language. Of course, there may be some cases where Sanskrit words and phrases may be used during rituals, but otherwise the rest of the studies are done in our own language. And then there are many Westerners who take interest in Tibetan language and Tibetan script. so many scholars say that these translations there in Tibetan are clearer and better than the translations in Chinese. So I thought this may be good for the for you to hear. For example, with regard to Heart Sutra, there is Chinese translation, and through China, there is translation into Japanese, Korean, Vietnam, the languages. And so when translation of Heart Sutra was done in Chinese, the Chinese translation of Heart Sutra, there, and one of the passages where the this Heart Sutra says the five aggregates also are empty of intrinsic existence, the term also or even is missing in the Chinese, but in the Sanskrit original there is this word also. So since the Buddhism, since the Heart Sutra was translated from Chinese into Japan and Korea and Vietnamese, from Chinese, therefore, for a thousand years, they have been reciting the Heart Sutra with missing this word. But whereas we have been reciting the Heart Sutra without missing it. So this term also has its own significance. What it shows is that not only the person is empty of inherent existence, but also the five psychophysical aggregates, which are the basis for the designation of a person, they too are empty of intrinsic existence. And then another meaning is during the first sermon of the Buddha, Buddha taught the selflessness of persons, and not selflessness of phenomena. Whereas during the second turning of the wheel of Dharma, the teachings on the perfection of wisdom, sutra, the selflessness of not only the selflessness of persons, but selflessness of phenomena is taught. And so there's a big difference, even with regard to one word. And therefore, the translation, Tibetan translations of Buddhist literature from Sanskrit is marvelous. So we have a very rich culture and religion. So if you are not interested in our own religion and culture, then you would be able to appreciate the what is there in English on the... So even then people lose any interest in our own culture and religion. This is, of course, they are not to be blamed for this, but in our society, we actually have this kind of a habit that when there is some kind of a drum and musical instruments being played in rituals, then everybody is like, pay attention to them. Of course, such cultures with masks and so forth are there in African tribes, among the African tribes. If you think about Nalanda monastic institution, we have not heard that Master Nagarjuna playing some cymbal and Aryadeva playing some other magical instruments and Buddhapalita playing drumming and so forth. We do not get this impression when we think about Nalanda institution. And so whereas when we think about Tibetan monasteries, people usually get this kind of impression that the monasteries are for rituals. So I told people in Ladakh that when, in the future, when people hear about such and such monastery, then the impression they should get is, oh, this is an institution for learning, a center for learning Buddhism. Whereas what the impression that we get today is that when we think about a monastery, or when somebody hears a monastery, talking about a monastery, referring to a monastery, then they have this impression of some rituals being performed. And so, whereas if we think about the Sera Garden Drepung monastic institutions, people usually get the idea, the impression of these institutions being centers of learning. And so we should make this possible for everyone to have this kind of impression when we refer to monasteries and as being centers for learning. And so we have rather neglected we are lost in trivial things. So otherwise the monasteries become places where people are more enthusiastic about making musical instruments from precious metals like gold or silver and so forth. So the wealth should not be external wealth that we should boast to others, but what the kind of wealth that we must accrue, accumulate, is the seven different wealth, such as being considerate to others and being feeling shamefulness and ashamed of being immoral and so forth. And so the 21st century, you should you should be honest and moral, not only based on what your parents tell you to do or not, but through reasoning. We should preserve the Buddhas. We should preserve our culture and religion through reason and logic. And then through that, we should develop conviction in our religion and culture. So in the beginning of our exiled life, there were many younger generation of Tibetans who were not so enthusiastic about our religion and culture. And then in the secular schools like Missouri and so forth, the students were taught the dialectical debate. One of the teachers was the late director of this Institute of Buddhist Dialectics in Miklorganj, who was later murdered. And so debate was introduced into these secular schools in the beginning. But then over time, people, the students lost interest, and then also the religious instructors also were not so enthusiastic about teaching dialectical debate. They were more lost in teaching rituals and prayers. And so time went by. We lost the opportunity in those days. So if we continue to if this continues, then the Tibetan identity, which is mainly the Buddhist concept, the teaching philosophy and the practice, the theory and practice of Buddhism, which means the view of dependent origination and the ethical practice of nonviolence. So if you live your life according to these two principles of the correct view of dependent origination and the conduct of nonviolence, then you will be live a happy life. So I usually jokingly tell people in the West that the younger generation that this is your century and only about 13 years have passed in this 13 years from this 21st century are gone, whereas you still have over 80 years. And so it's possible for you to have a peaceful and nonviolent world, 21st century, and you should be able to. Then I tell them that perhaps after death, we who belong to the 20th century, maybe in heaven, I will watch you. And in Australia, isn't I told people that if perhaps I may be in, I would be in hell realm in 20 years or something like that. But even if I may be in hell, I will take leave for a week or so and come to the earth and watch you. And so we live on this earth, and we have immediate relation with China and India. So we're not talking, but we don't have to talk about converting people to a religion, but we should be role models to share our moral principles. So in order for that to happen, we are gathered here for that purpose. If only the education of modern subjects is enough, then we do not need to gather like this. So for the last several years, we have gathered here in order to actually develop within ourselves and cultivate these principles within ourselves. And so to keep this in mind. And with regard to past and future lives, it's whether you believe in it or not, it's up to you. You have to give your thoughts to them. Of course, when it comes to practicing Buddhism, of course, then you should have belief in Buddhism, past and future lives. Otherwise, you would only be insisting your own personal view that there is no past and future lives without much reason. The only reason that you would have give is that you do not see it, which is not a good reason. And in Tibet, I was with some Chinese, and I asked him, "Well, what is a human being?" He couldn't. I asked for the definition of a human being, and he was not able to give the definition. Whereas we usually say that a human being is someone who can actually has a language to speak and to understand. And then I asked him whether there is past and future lives, and he said no. And I asked him why, and he said, "I cannot see past and future life." And then I said, "If everything that is there, is it possible? Is it necessary that everything that is there, you should see if something exists?" And he said no. And so you cannot just say that past and future lives do not are not there just because you do not see. No. So yesterday I told you that some scholar told me that 25% of people in Europe and America in the West believe in past and future lives. So on the basis of this understanding of past and future lives, we can explain the difference amongst people, and we cannot make the distinction just on the basis of genes. So if I could finish the text, I will. But even if I cannot finish it this time, we'll leave the rest. So first I'll do the initiation of Manjushri. So with regard to Buddhism, we have the Pali tradition, which is spread in Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, and Cambodia, and so forth. And they have very good practice of Vinaya, the monastic code of discipline, except for the minor differences in numbers of the precepts. We also have the same Vinaya practice. And then in the Sanskrit tradition, which spread to China, which is the Sanskrit tradition of Buddhism, is very vast. So some 3 years ago, one university in Beijing did a survey of, and they found that there are 300 Buddhists in China. We Tibetans are only 6 million. And then I met recently, when I met some scholars, they said that now the number has increased, gone up to 400 million. So, so China, where during the Cultural Revolution they thought of destroying what are called the four olds for old things. Now has 400 million Buddhists, Buddhist population, whereas in India it may be not even 200 million. So China has the biggest population of Buddhists in the world today. Then today, one fact is that every week, Chinese from mainland China, I meet 10 to 20, 15 to 20 every week. So most of them, when they see me, they cry and they request me not to forget them, the people in China. And I tell them that I will not forget you, but the Chinese, the government has labeled me a demon. And I was in Italy one time, and I met many mayors of different Italian cities. I was invited by them, and then I met the media people, and one of the media persons said that the Chinese government is saying that you are a demon. And I said, yes, I am a demon with horns like this. I did this gesture, and the picture came on the newspapers. And then recently I also said to people that these horns of the demon is actually growing longer and longer. And so I told these Chinese that if I came to China, then as a demon, my palace would be prison. So with regard to religion or Buddhism, there's no difference between race or caste or anything like that. So there's changes are going on in China. So in other words, the moral ethics that we have in our which is our heritage must not be neglected. So many of the monks in the huge monastic institutions mostly are these days are from the Ladakh and the Himalayan regions of India, And our own children, the number of our own children joining these monasteries are very small these days. And perhaps this may be due to the school teachers and the staff may have some responsibility in this. And then the people coming out of Tibet, and join these monasteries are now becoming less. So, children, people from schools like this should actually be able to join the monastic institutions. So, of course, to do study of Buddhist philosophy, one does not necessarily have to be a monastic. And so then amongst the nuns, we have now nuns who are soon going to be female geshe-mas. So amongst the lay people, we may have to, of course there are, we have some opportunities and facilities. Like the Central University for Tibetan Studies in Sarnath. So we have to still think about establishing such institutions for lay people. So Buddhism, amongst the Sanskrit, the countries where Sanskrit tradition has spread, the complete teaching of the Buddha, comprising the Vinaya practice of monastic code of conduct, and then the Bodhisattva practices, and then the secret esoteric practice of Tantra, having all these practices of these three different systems, according to the Nyingma tradition, there are the nine vehicles. Which are practiced by our single individual in one sitting. And we have such a culture which can be used to advise other people. And then I have met one Japanese scholar and also who's also an abbot. And one day I had a discussion with him, and he told me that all of us recite the Heart Sutra, but we do not understand the meaning of Heart Sutra despite reciting it. And therefore, he told me that your explanation of Heart Sutra is very helpful. So please, and he requested me to explain the Heart Sutra whenever I can in Japan. And so usually the Japanese are quite solemn and like formality, but he really frankly told me these. So there is a saying that when you have to discuss with Japanese leaders, you would not know whether they are actually responding to you saying yes or no. They show a very solemn kind of face, and it's very difficult to tell whether they are saying yes or no. So we have this Nalanda, authentic Nalanda tradition, which can be actually an authentic source. And we do not have to rely on small texts.
then of course there may be people who claim to have clairvoyance and miraculous supernatural powers, exhibiting supernatural powers and so forth, but these are also there amongst the even amongst the non-Buddhist practitioners. They have clairvoyance and they can also exhibit miraculous powers. And so just because someone is very accurate in his small divination or have some kind of clairvoyance, we should not be attracted to them. And so you should be very wise to make the right kind of judgment about our treasure that we have, this religion and cultural tradition that we have. So it is very important to have wisdom and intelligence to make the right kind of decision. And so I'm going to give the blessing of Gang Loma. Dogon Namda Shin, which is a mandala offering for this initiation. I met some the people from the medical and astrological institute. They had some conference recently, and there were some participants from the West, Americans and so forth, and then Tibetan medical doctors also participated. And I told them that regarding cosmology, we need to accept what modern science has to say, because they actually give their presentation, make their presentation through observation, and we cannot hold on to the old view that there is Mount Meru and so forth. I personally do not believe that Mount Meru is there on this earth. Whereas, despite rejecting Mount Meru, I told them that we could still do the a practice of mandala offering. Because in the mandala offering, we are talking about the 3,000 world systems that we imagine. And I do make mandala offerings. And but although I do not believe in Mount Meru, in Drepung, I heard that somebody said that now that the Dalai Lama has nullified the Mount Meru. Of course, I didn't nullify Mount Meru, but we have, in our logic, we say that if something is actually accessible to our perceptions, they must be seen. Whereas something which is perceptible, and if it's not, cannot be seen, then, and still, if you have to say that we have to accept it, we are not being logical. And so even if something may be your own thesis, but if that thesis is actually rejected through logic and reasoning, you must give it up. And so Jerembuche has said that someone who holds on to some view which is against reason and logic cannot be taken as authentic and authoritative. And so if that is the case, then if we go against something which is perceptual phenomena, so imagine a flat world and then Mount Meru in the center and then the sun and the moon going around the Mount Meru at the same height. So one time I was in Bandra, a Tibetan settlement, and there was an exhibition set up by the school in the Tibetan settlement. And in that exhibition, one of the exhibition was on the solar system, then lunar and solar eclipse. And so there was one small girl who told me that we Tibetans When solar and lunar eclipse happen, we say that the sun and moon are being eaten up by Rahu. And this is not the case, she told me. And when the sun, lunar and solar eclipse happen, the moon and the earth come between the sun and the moon and sun and the earth. And so I also listened to her very attentively because I said, oh, that is that so? Is that so? And I listened to her very carefully. Of course, it would have made her very happy. And so she very confidently was telling me all this. So, which was very good, of course. She had the knowledge to give the presentation to me. So first, for the purpose of this particular ritual, imagine me as Manjushri with a upala flower in my left hand and in my right hand the wisdom sword, and on the upala flower imagine a scripture and then the Manjushri, you can also see image of Manjushri on the altar. So you have to imagine me as Manjushri, similar to the Manjushri on the altar, as we had the question yesterday. When we talk about Saraswati, the goddess Saraswati, we usually have the we should make some distinction between the worldly and the transcendental deities. So amongst the transcendent dental deities, when we meditate and visualize ourselves as the deities, whichever deity you are doing practice on, then through that practice you transform into that deity. And then when you also visualize the mandala of the deity, the mandala, the palace, the celestial mansion is also the manifestation of the enlightened wisdom of the deity. And therefore we have different mandalas. Goddess Saraswati may be revered by Buddhists as well as Hindus. And in the case of Hinduism, they say that one of the manifestations of avatars of Ishwar is Buddha Shakyamuni. And so we can also relate the same logic to the other deities. So now the important thing here is regarding enlightenment, Buddhahood. In order to reach that highest goal of Buddhahood, so Buddhism is mainly focused on developing oneself and culminating, so that one culminates into a Buddhahood. So not only mere liberation from samsara is the focus of Buddhism. So one of the means to become enlightened is the understanding of emptiness, the view of emptiness. But the view of emptiness alone cannot lead you to the omniscient state of Buddhahood, but it must be complemented by the principle of bodhicitta. And therefore, bodhicitta becomes the principal practice of that leads one to the state of Buddhahood. And therefore, have the intention to lead all sentient beings to enlightenment. Just as you have Buddha nature within yourself, likewise all other sentient beings have this Buddha nature within them, and therefore they have the potential to become a Buddha, and therefore just as I have the potential and there's a possibility for me to become a Buddha, likewise all the other sentient beings have the potential and the possibility for becoming a Buddha. So it's a matter of whether you become aware of this fact or not. So if you meditate on emptiness and cultivate the wisdom of emptiness, then you will be able to overcome all the delusions, ignorance. And so if you cultivate this wisdom, realizing emptiness, which makes us full, you fulfill your goal, the ultimate goal of Buddhahood. So, of course, all the Buddhas always think of helping all other sentient beings to lead them to enlightenment, Buddhahood. But as individuals, we should also have this determination to become a Buddha for the benefit of all sentient beings in order to be able to help those sentient beings with whom I have a very strong karmic connection. And so without my becoming enlightened, I cannot help these sentient beings with whom I have this kind of karmic connection. So if you think of neglecting these, if you neglect such sentient beings to lead them to the state of enlightenment, it would not be good for you. So in the sutras, we find mention of the Bodhisattva, who is called Dakdongwu, who had visions of many Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. But then these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas could have helped him, but they prophesied that his karmic connection was with the Bodhisattva Chöpak Dharmuttara. And then he was sent to this Bodhisattva. So now have this strong determination to help all other sentient beings out of samsara and in order to lead them to the Buddhahood thing, and they have this intention to become a Buddha for their benefit. So when you have this kind of altruistic intention, altruistic state of mind, then it helps you in this life, and spiritually, mentally, and emotionally, and it will help you physically as well. So when you have this kind of determination to become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings across space, then not only in the three realms of its existence as such, but what is most precious in the whole of samsara and nirvana is bodhicitta, which is this heart dedicated for the well-being of other sentient beings to lead them to Buddhahood. So to have the complete and unmistaken courses to lead oneself to the omniscient state, you need to know what these courses and conditions are that brings about such a result. And for that, it is indispensable to wisdom is indispensable. wisdom which distinguishes the ultimate reality of things. So it's not enough just to read books and also listen to the lectures of teachers, but you need to reflect on what you have studied and then gain conviction in them, and therefore so such wisdom which draws on reflection is called inferential cognition. Of course, it may not be necessarily that, but once you have gained conviction in the different subject matters, then you should familiarize your mind with them, and then have some experience which comes about when you put effort, and then you would have a true practice. So otherwise, as Rinpoche says, you should not do practice whatever comes by. And please say this prayer. Jeso yi rang gui xin so wa yi ge wa chung se da gi chi tam je do be chung ju whatever slight positive potential I may have created by paying homage, offering and acknowledging my faults, confessing, rejoicing in the request and requesting that the Buddha stay and teach, I now dedicate all this for full awakening. Whatever slight positive potential I may have created by praying homage, offering, confessing, rejoicing and requesting that the Buddha stay and teach, I now dedicate all this for full awakening. So this we have recited the seven limb, done the seven limb practice. And so now, as I said earlier, imagine me, the Lama, here as Manjushri with one face, two hands, and from my forehead, imagine rays of light being emitted into the 10 directions. And imagine all the different offerings. And all, in fact, the offerings should be imagined as being in the nature of all the positive practices that you have done, the merits and virtues that you have collected throughout the three times, and transforming into these offering objects. And see that everything is like illusion, although they do appear to have some independent existence, solid and in existence that they do not exist as such. And so these rays of light which are emitted from the master's forehead goes in different directions. They invoke the blessings of the Manjushri, Bodhisattvas in the birth. And they, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in 10 directions, blessings from them come and are dissolved into the my forehead. Let us say this prayer. Homage to Guru and Protector who holds in his heart a scriptural text symbolic of seeing all things as they are, whose intelligence shines forth unclouded by delusions or traces of ignorance, full of compassion, who teaches it 60 ways with loving compassion, O Father, for his only Son, all creatures caught in the prison of samsara, confused in the darkness of their ignorance, overwhelmed by suffering, you Buddha, whose dragon thunder-like proclamation of Dharma arouses us from the stupor of our delusions and frees us from the iron chains of karma, who wills the world, sword wisdom, hewing down suffering, whatever its spouts appear. And so these, with this prayer invocation, rays of light are emitted from the master's forehead and they come to the disciples and they dissolve into the forehead of the disciples, thereby receiving the blessings of the body of Manjushri. And similarly, rays of light are emitted from the throat of the guru, the Lama, and they go out in different directions and in the form of the different offerings, which are in essence the virtues collected through the three times, and they invoke the blessings of the speech of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and these blessings dissolve into the throat of the Guru. And so now make your request to the Guru for the blessing of the speech of Manjushri. And so imagine rays of light emitting, being emitted from the throat of the Guru, and invoke the blessings of the Buddha, Bodhisattvas in 10 directions, and they come down in the form of light and dissolve into the Guru's throat. Homage to the Guru and protector who holds to his heart the scriptural text, symbolic of seeing all things as they are, whose intelligence shines forth unclouded by delusions and traces of ignorance, full of compassion, clearing away the darkness of ignorance, you whose darkness of ignorance, you whose princely body is adorned with the 112 marks of the Buddha, who has completed the stages of achieving the highest perfection of Bodhisattva, and who has been pure from the beginning, I bow down to Manjushri. And so rays of light come from the Guru's throat, and they dissolve into the throat of the disciples. So imagine that they come to you, and these rays of light coming from the Guru's throat dissolve into your throat, and with this you are blessed with the speech of the Manjushri, and thereby making you, giving you the capability to serve others through your speech. And then again, from the heart of the Guru, the rays of light emit into the 10 directions, invoking the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in 10 directions, and drawing their blessings, and which dissolve into the heart. Please say the prayer again. Mentum dunge kisere drozo kun la pujik tarze yang la chuk ju yang den son to thy prostitution before the Guru in the garden and noble in the back of Manjushri, your intelligence shines forth to make the sun free from the clouds of truth obscurations, enabling you to see the extent of all things and how the does you hold scriptural text. Your reflection for all vast masses who wander plagued with problems, groping in the darkness of ignorance in the dungeons of our compulsive existences, like that of your only child, thus your speech is melodious with 60 faces. And so with this prayer invocation, you imagine now that the blessings of the heart or the mind of Manjushri, mainly great compassion and bodhicitta, which is complemented by the two types of aspirations, aspiration for to benefit others and aspiration for enlightenment, Buddhahood. And also the understanding of emptiness, the wisdom of emptiness, all these come. I mean, the blessings of all these qualities of the mind of Manjushri come forth to you in the form of light, and they dissolve into your heart, and from the heart of the Guru, and they dissolve into your heart, and thereby receiving the blessings of the wisdom of emptiness and bodhicitta and great compassion. And now imagine a wheel, orange, eight-spoked wheel at the heart of the Guru, who is indivisible or inseparable from Manjushri. These with six spokes and a wheel with six spokes. On each spoke is each syllable of Arapatsana. And in the center is the D syllable. And as you recite this mantra, repeat this mantra, you have to imagine these syllables coming from my heart into you. If you have not received any initiation before, you can just imagine that blessings of Manjushri, in terms of the wisdoms of Manjushri, which do just away with the four kinds of inappropriate wisdoms, such as wisdom going astray and so forth, are dispelled. So please repeat this. Omarabhazanadi. 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 Please recite Omarabhazanadi and imagine these six syllables coming from my heart and dissolving into your heart. Omarabhazanadi, 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 Omarabhazanadi,
So imagine these syllable, the seed syllable of Manjushri at your throat, inside your throat, standing at your throat, and from this the emits light, and they invoke the blessings of the body, speech, and mind of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and especially the blessing of retentive memory or unforgettable memory, which imagine that these blessings of unforgettable memory comes from the blessing of unforgettable memory comes from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in the form of this syllable. They dissolve into the this syllable at your heart. Throat. And then say in one breath 100 the syllable, recite the syllable 100 times, but we can at each and so, but don't fart. In Australia was I had a question. Did a public talk, and then the MC was from Ghana, and she told me about that she has lots of gastric problem, and I told her that I also have this problem, and I told her that on the plane. I told him that of course I also have this problem, and when I am traveling on the planes, I do look around, and if nobody is around, coming around, then I actually lift my butt and let out the gas, and so everybody laughed at that time, and so one of the former officials, Tibetan officials, told me that he was behind one Indian. So Gadang actually told me that he was behind some Indian who was actually farting while walking along for him. And then Gadang told me that he also did the same, farted. And then at that point, that Indian actually looked at him, turned around and looked at him as if he did something wrong.
So breathe in and then recite Om Marapasana and say D 100 times. Om Marapasana. Now imagine that. Imagine that the from the D at your throat, drops of D also fall on the D in the center of the chakra, the wheel at your heart, and then you swallow your saliva, push the D at your. Imagine that you are pushing the D at your throat into the D at your heart. So as I said yesterday, I usually remember the Buddha. As soon as I wake up, I make prayer to be a good follower of the Buddha. And then, as you do your washing or doing your work, you should recite this prayer of Manjushri. If possible, if you should recite the Om Arapasanadi, this whole mantra, one round of mala, and we'll do this recitation of the D syllable, and then pause a while, and imagine the D syllable dropping, the drops of the D syllable going. And then at some point you can take a rest and fart, imagining that all the ignorance has been let out. And so you could do this experiment yourself. If you do recitation of this mantra every day, after saying the prayer, the praise of Manjushri, once in the beginning, you will see some difference in your wisdom and intelligence growing. And then your study of Buddhism should go well, and study of Buddhism has to be must be done throughout your life. Benjamin Lobson Chögyen always was studying different texts, and at one point, and then he got a vision where the deity talked to him and said that even those Arya Bodhisattvas who have reached the Bodhisattva grounds through the third Bodhisattva grounds and so forth, are never contented with learning and studying. And so the texts that were written by Tibetan masters should be used like keys, which have actually drawn the essence of all the classical texts written by Indian masters and also the words of the Buddha. And so we have to study these the classical Indian texts by using the Tibetan commentaries as key to them. So, chapter 3, reasons for the presentation of Buddha's teaching as the three baskets. It is because in our mind and secondary minds are under the control of delusions, that we continue to experience the spinning of the wheel of suffering and cycling. If that is abandoned, liberation is attained. Therefore, we must principally subdue the delusions such as attachment in our mind stream. The supplement Victor Buddha taught the means to subdue in 84,000 heaps of doctrine. If those are reduced, there are 12 scriptural categories. If condensed more concisely, they are known as the three baskets, which are the baskets of discourse, the baskets of discourse, discipline, and knowledge. The reasons for maintaining these three baskets is stated in Arya Maitreya's Ornament for Mahayana Sutra. Nine reasons are accepted for the collections of teachings being condensed into two or three. Of these nine reasons, there are three relate to what is to be abandoned, three relate to that in which to train, and three relate to what is to be known. First, the three objects to be abandoned are the secondary delusions of doubt, the secondary delusion leading to the two extremes of conduct, and the secondary delusion is certain the superiority of one's own view. The antidotes to those are taught as the basket of discourse, the basket of discipline, and the basket of knowledge, respectively. The basket of discourses clearly explains the aggregates, constituent sources, dependent risings, four noble truths, the grounds, and the perfections, being primarily concerned with the training and meditative stabilization. It dispels wavering doubts concerning the on the basis of general and specific characteristics phenomena. Therefore, the basket of discourses was taught as an antidote to secondary delusions. The basket of discipline prohibits engagement in all prescribed misdeeds such as sexual misconduct, attachment to external and internal sensual objects such as good food, clothes, and dwellings, which, when one is subsisting on alms, is an extreme of desire. So with regard to taking meat, it is said that the meat must be free from three faults, and according to Vinaya, and therefore in Vinaya, according to Vinaya, eating meat is not prohibited for monks and nuns, and therefore in Thailand and Burma and Sri Lanka, the monks are not necessarily vegetarian. And one time, long time ago, I met one Sri Lankan monk who told me that Buddhist monks are neither vegetarian nor non-vegetarian. He told me the reason why he said this is because as monks, we do not have our own kitchen. And we actually subsist on alms. We go on begging. For food. And so I once did this practice of going for alms, begging for alms, and around Bodh Gaya. So the sponsors who give these alms, if they are vegetarian, we must take the meal offered by them. And if the sponsors themselves, the family, is non-vegetarian, then the food they offer must be accepted. So we cannot demand the food from them. I want this, I want that. We cannot demand such the food that we want. So whatever comes into our alms bowl must be accepted. And so he told me this is the reason. In the Mahayana Sutras, there is prohibition of meat eating. Therefore, in China and Japan, the Mahayana practitioners, the Buddhist practitioners, are vegetarian. And so they have these kind of sutras as their support. I asked about this to Kunun Lama Tenzin Gyaltsen. He told me that in the Mahayana scriptures, some scriptures prohibit non-veg meal and others do not prohibit. For example, the heart of the essence of middle way, For example, by Bhav Viveka, mentions that if you find a meat of some animal which has already been killed, then that meat is not something that was intentionally meant for you, and therefore you can But then, because there is meat eaters, there would be providers, the people who sell meat. And so in the Mahayana scriptures, we find both the views, where in some the meat is prohibited, in others it's not. Whereas in tantric practice, there is the practice of taking meat. Of course, it's not just ordinary meat that we eat, but we have to understand that within the context of tantric practice, those meats are actually blessed and transformed into nectars. And you have to understand the various context within Buddhism itself as to the vegetarianism and non-vegetarianism. So the basic of discipline prohibits engagement in all prescribed meat dishes. And however, if one maintains the immaculate ethics of renunciation, it is unnecessary to exert efforts to obtain wealth and so forth. When one has the ability to curtail strong attachment, one is permitted to make use of even luxurious clothes, food, dwellings, and so forth. If one then imposes austerity upon oneself, it is an extreme. The basket of discipline is taught as an antidote to the secondary delusion leading to the two extremes of conduct, because it reveals the antidotes to both the extreme of austerity and the extreme of desire while subsisting on extreme of austerity and extreme of desire while subsisting. So with regard to the extreme of desire while subsisting on to alms, it has to be actually understood to mean that if you excessively obsess with your sensual pleasures and desire, then you would actually deplete your positive energies that you have collected before. And so it has to be the extreme of desire depleting your merit instead of subsisting on else arms. To summarize, if the delusions, attachment, pride, conceit, and so on do not arise when one uses food, good food, clothes, dwellings, beddings, etc., these are permitted by Buddha, and a proscribed fault will not have been committed. However, if attachment, etc., increase when using even meager food, ragged clothes, and the like, then a fault proscribed by the Buddha will have been committed. The principal concern of such permission and restriction is solely with the increase or decrease of delusions, desire, attachment, etc., within the mind, not with external objects. The basket of knowledge clearly explains the specific characteristics of phenomena. And the general characteristics such as impermanence, suffering, and selflessness, listening to, thinking about, the acting on such teachings will automatically rectify the wrong views such as purity, happiness, impermanence, and conceptions of self, which are all the wrong kind of views, misperceptions, and from which spring the misconceptions that deviant ethics and aesthetics practices are worthwhile. For this reason, the basket of knowledge was explained as an antidote to clinging to the superiority of one's own view. Next, the three reasons relating to that which is to train, in which to train. The basket of discourse takes the three trainings as its subject matter, while the purpose of the basket of discipline is to establish two trainings of ethics and meditative stabilization, and the purpose of the basket of knowledge is to accomplish the training of wisdom. The three baskets were revealed in accordance with these three reasons too. However, how do the three trainings of the Mahayana and Hinayana form the content of the basket of discourses? So according to the ethics of Hinayana, the basket of discourse explains the discipline of individual emancipation vows, which restrain the mind stream, the maintenance of completely pure behavior and tradition, and the Thank you. And so with regard to these practices, there are also, we have the practice of 37 factors leading to enlightenment, and also the meditation on emptiness, which is the meditation on the ultimate reality. It explains the concentration of states, mental stabilization and formless absorptions, and the training in wisdom, which is special insight, seeing the Four Noble Truths as they are. According to Mahayana, the basket of discipline explains ethics such as restraint from misdeeds, the training in meditative stabilization such as the sky treasure and going like a hero, and the training in wisdom, which is the non-conceptual intuitive wisdom that understands the ultimate mode of reality. The basket of discipline describes the way to practice the two trainings of ethics and meditative stabilization, for it shows unerringly what is to be cultivated and engaged in, what is to be abandoned and refrained from. Thus, it specifically purifies ethics. If ethics is pure, if ethics are pure in this way, we will not experience anguish or regret. Free from those, physical suppleness or ecstasy is attained, and dependent on that, mental joy and bliss increases. Consequently, the mind will not abide single-pointedly. Thus, the training in ethics and meditative stabilization are accomplished by following the basket of discipline. The basket of knowledge describes the way to accomplish the training in wisdom by clearly classifying the characteristics of all phenomena, studying them generates the wisdom correctly, recognizing the characteristics of all phenomena, thereby specifically achieving the higher training of wisdom. Lastly, the reason relating to what is to be known, the discourse explains the doctrine and its purposes. Discipline accomplishes the practice of the doctrine and its purpose. The knowledge yields mastery of the doctrine, the purpose and related topics. The discourses reveal the inner meaning of the Dharma by explaining in great detail the terms, words, and syllables, and the meanings they convey, that is, the meaning of aggregates and constituents and sources, etc., or the aggregates and constituents, etc., or phenomena. The meaning of eight interpretive discourses, or the doctrine of the path of 10 virtues by which to obtain high status, and the meaning of 37 paths directed towards the enlightenment by which to gain the qualities of definite goodness. The purpose of this recognition is to enable one to train accordingly. The way of basket discipline achieves the purpose of the Dharma is that in leading to purity of ethics and through revealing the meditation on ugliness, the delusions are subdued. When such insights and realizations are actualized in the mind stream, the purpose of Dharma is achieved. Study of the basket of knowledge results in mastery of the doctrine, its purpose, and related topics. So with regard to the content, the subject matter of the three baskets, so chapter 4, what then are the three trainings? First is the higher training in ethics, which is the foundation of all qualities and the summary of the essential practice of Buddha's teaching. As Nagarjuna says in friendly letter, discipline is taught to be the foundation of all qualities, as the earth is for the animated and animate. There are many kinds of ethics based on the discipline of avoiding the 10 unwholesome actions. When codified, there are three sets of these: the ethics of individual liberation, ethics of bodhisattva, and that of the sacred mantra. And so as long as you are a Buddhist, you should avoid the 10 non-virtuous actions. And so this is the first stage, which culminates in the attainment of nirvana or cessation. And so right from the beginning, you restrain your body, speech, and mind, and then you build on the rest of the practices. And so first is to avoid the non-virtuous practices, and then the second, in the middle, you should meditate on selflessness and overcome delusions or afflictive emotions. Meditating on selflessness of persons, and then finally you should meditate on the selflessness of phenomena, and to overcome even the traces of the ignorance and cognitive obscurations. So when codified, sets three in the ethics of liberation. As Ajaya Vasubandhu says in Treasury of Knowledge, abbreviating them roughly, 10 parts of either virtuous or unwholesome actions were taught. So 10 unwholesome actions, the 10 unwholesome actions are three of body, taking life, taking what is not given, sexual misconduct, four of speech, lying, divisive talk, harsh words, and idle chatter, three of mind, covetousness, malice, and wrong view. These 10 parts of actions are committed and accumulated through the three doors of body, speech, and mind. Taking life, there are five factors to taking life: object, sentient being of a different continuum from oneself, thought, recognition of the object, action, one's own act of killing or inciting others to kill through poison, weapons, or mantras, etc. Delusion, hatred in particular, and delusions of desire, hatred, and ignorance in general. Completion, the victim dies before one does oneself. When these five parts of action of taking life is complete, with these five, the path of action of taking life is complete. If any of these factors is missing, the path of action will become complete, although a fault is still will still have been committed. This should also be understood with reference to actions described below. There are three categories of taking life through attachment because of craving for meat, taking life through hatred because of malice, and through taking life through ignorance, as, for example, in making animal sacrifices. Of all the acts of taking life, taking that of a foe destroyer, one's guru or parents, ordained beings, the learned, and so forth, are the worst. Taking what is not given, object something. Please read on. We are on lying, the fourth and virtuous object, the person other than oneself. Fourth, the intention to deceive others, being motivated by the wish to speak of what one has or has not seen, action and expression of body or speech, and delusion, any of the three poisons in general. Completion, occurs when the other person has understood what is meant. Here, the action does not only include expressions and deception of speech, but also lying through physical gestures. There are three kinds of lies: those concerning supramundane attainments, such as claiming to have attained higher qualities than one has, which constitutes a defeat; great lies, which bring benefit or harm to self and others; petty lies bring neither benefit nor harm. Of all lies, those deprecating the Buddha or deceiving gurus and parents are the worst. Divisive speech. Object, other people living in harmony. Thought, the wish to divide them. Action, to begin to do so. Delusion, hatred in particular, and the three parts in general. Completion, when the purpose is accomplished. When those who are in conflict are attempting to unite, to try to divide them again by thought or action is also included here. There are three kinds of divisive speech: forceful slander, which divides friends directly, hinting, which divides through insinuation, and speech, which divides through underhandedness. One of the varieties of divisive speech, that which separates a guru and disciple, causes a schism. Schism in the spiritual community is the worst. Harsh words, object, the mind of a sentient being; thought, the wish to speak unpleasantly; action, to make an effort in it; delusion, hatred in particular, and the three poisons in general; completion, the action, expression of speech. There are three categories of harsh words: rough speech, directly exposing the bad qualities of others, speaking roughly by implication, mixing harsh words with jokes, and oblique rough speech, telling others of their friend's bad qualities, of the writer's harsh words, those spoken to parents and superiors are the worst. Idle chatter object the mind of a sentient being for the wish to chatter incessantly without care. Action to begin to voice songs, flattery and so forth, delusion, ignorance in particular, and the support in general, completion, direction, expression of speech. There are three kinds of idle chatter: mistaken speech, such as the citation of heterodox. Citations of the heterodox, nonsense like worldly gossip, and are uselessly speaking the truth, such as the teaching the doctrine to an appropriate vessel. Of the varieties of idle gossip, that which distracts those who aspire solely towards the Dharma is the worst. Covetousness. Object, the material possession of inner qualities of others, thoughts, wishing and hoping for others' wealth and possessions. Action, to think of it repeatedly, delusion, attachment, particularly in three parts in general. Completion, to perform the action repeatedly, abandoning shame and embarrassment, and not to apply antidotes. These are three kinds of covetousness: the attachment to class and family lineage, which is covet what is one's own; attachment to others' wealth, which is covet what belongs to others; and wishing for treasure beneath the earth, which is to covet what is neither of these. Now, variety of covetousness: to covet the possessions of a renunciate is the worst. Malice. Then wrong view. The ethics of individual liberation is so called because thereby an individual becomes free from the suffering of cycling existence. By nature, it is a precept received by a motivating wish to achieve definite release from cycling existence, not merely a prayer for goodness or protection from fears, but aspiration for peace for oneself. The ethics of individual liberation are to abandon harming others as well as the primary and secondary thoughts to do so. If the ethics of individual liberation are classified according to the holder, Vesubandhu says, within the four general categories, there are eight kinds of individual liberation. These are the layperson's one-day vow, both layman's and laywomen's vows, both female and male and female novice vows, the probationary nun vows, and they're both fully ordained monk and nun vows. These are the eight classes of individual liberation vows. There are eight precepts to be observed within the layperson's one-day vow, and the five laymen and women's general precepts. A novice has 36 precepts of observation and abandonment, including the minor faults to be avoided. On top of the novice precepts, a probationary nun has 6 root and 6 secondary doctrines, 12 precepts in all, which she must observe. A fully ordained monk must observe 253 precepts, which include our 4 defeats, 30 mementos, 30 propelling downfalls, 90 solitary simple downfalls, and 4 individual confessions, and 112 faults. A fully ordained nun must observe 364 precepts, which include 8 defeats, 20 remainders, 33 propelling downfalls, 180 simple downfalls, and 11 individual confessions, and 112 faults. The first of the 8 categories of individual liberation, the lay person's one-day vow, is efficacious because it's observed for the duration of 1 day. The remaining 7 must be observed until death, for they are received for the duration of this life. The recipient of these vows should be free from such hindrances as being obstructed from generating the vows by having performed the boundless action, not receiving the permission of one's rulers or parents, which hinders maintaining the vow, being unable to drive away cows, which is the hindrance to immaturity, hindrance of immaturity, and not having golden hair or a pretty nose, which indicates the inordinate beauty. That inordinate beauty is a hindrance. Apart from these, no distinction is made between those of high or low caste, the rich or poor. One may receive the vows if one is able to practice them according to one's mental capacity. There are two traditions for receiving the vows that have been taken previously. The earlier system, which does not require much elaboration, and the present system, requiring great complexity. So with regard to taking the vows, such as the one-day vow, or the layperson with vows, the upasaka and upasaki, within which there are layperson with all the five precepts, and layperson with five precepts and keeping celibacy, or you can take either one or two or three or four vows. So it's good if you could take these vows as layperson, as people, and whether you take vows or not, or the 10 non-virtuous actions are something which we as Buddhists must avoid. Except for the wrong view, which is the 10th of the 10 non-virtuous actions, which may be interpreted according to different religious traditions, but the rest of the wrong views, the non-virtuous actions, are common to even the non-Buddhist traditions. So all the religious practitioners practice them. So it's all necessary. I finished reading chapter 4, and we're on chapter 5, training in meditative stabilization. Chapter 5, and the first page 31, then page 32.
Sitting in the middle of the road, and
Page 34. So, of course, the three realms of existence are mentioned in the text. Now, how do we actually prove that there are these three realms? They should have to be understood on the basis of the subtle degrees of subtlety of mind.
Yeah.
So because there is the decrease of subtlety within the mind, therefore, as a result of using the mind, there are these degrees also of the subtleties within the results or the fruits that they brought about. And therefore, we have the three realms of existence on the basis of the mind and the different degrees of subtlety, where the higher realms are more... have more of a concentration, single-bound concentration than the desire realm mind. And within the concentration, single-bound concentration, there is a difference in the in subtlety between the two higher realms of form and formless realms. So with regard to, on page 58, there are mentions of the nine sets of desire delusions and the three sets of great desire delusions. So the Madhyamakas who assert that nothing exists inherently, even in convention, explanation and the demonstration of the final reality of things is very subtle. Those philosophical schools which assert that things do have some inherent existence have their presentation of the afflictive emotions. And because all these afflictive emotions, and when we make this division into nine delusions within the desire realm, we have to really go into the subtle presentation of them from the point of view of the Madhyamakas who reject any inherent or intrinsic existence, even in convention. So page 59, mental contemplation of final training is similar analysis which eliminates even the subtle three sets of small desire delusions by the force of antidotes. So of course as you develop in your concentration, single point of concentration and have the experience of the first realm of concentration, the actual concentration of the first realm within the formless realm and so forth, and you have not of course overcome, completely eliminated the desire realm, called the delusions as such, but they are more or less suppressed. So the understanding of liberation is that by putting an end to the karma and delusions, there is liberation. And so this, by recognizing or identifying liberation that way, then when we develop these concentrations, we have the concentrations which are common to the worldly experiences, and then there are those which are transworldly. The actual stage of the first concentration has five branches: investigating, analyzing, analysis are both antidotes. Joy and bliss are both benefits, and single point of mind is the basis. When it includes both investigation and analysis, it is called ordinary actual stage, and when there is analysis but no investigation, it is called special actual stage. The preparation for the second concentration is to recognize the drawbacks of the first concentration and the flawless qualities of the second through mental contemplation of knowledge of individual characteristics and so forth. When one is thereby freed from attachment to the first concentration, the second will be attained. The actual stage of the second concentration has four branches, such as perfect clarity, etc. Of these, internal clarity is an antidote, while joy and bliss being produced from meditative stabilization are benefits. Meditative stabilization itself is the branch of abiding. Here, internal clarity refers to the mindfulness, introspection, and equanimity of that very stage. Because it has abandoned all internal conceptions, it is called internal clarity. The preparation for third concentration is to recognize the drawbacks of the second concentration and the qualities of the third through the analysis of the six mental contemplations. When one is thereby freed from attachment to the second concentration, the actual stage of the third concentration will be attained. And then actual stage of the third concentration has five branches: mindfulness, introspection, and equanimity are antidotes. As joy has been abandoned, bliss is the benefit. The meditative stabilization is the branch of abiding. The preparation for the fourth concentration is to recognize the drawbacks of the third concentration and the qualities of the fourth through the analysis of the six mental contemplations. When one is thereby freed from attachment to the third concentration, the actual stage of fourth concentration has four branches. Perfect mindfulness and perfect equanimity are both antidotes. The feeling of equanimity is the benefit, and meditative stabilization is the branch of abiding. Here, perfect mindfulness refers to complete freedom from the eight faults of concentration, so it is free from both investigation and analysis, which is amplifier in relation to the first concentration, from the feelings of pleasure and pain, which arise concomitant with sense perception in relation to the second concentration, from the feelings of bliss and unhappiness, which arise concomitant with mental perception in relation to the third concentration, and from inhalation and exhalation in relation to the fourth concentration. The above branches of concentration are 18 in name, but 11 in actuality. As Acharya Vasubandhu states in his Treasury of Knowledge, the first has five branches: investigation, analysis, joy, bliss, and meditative stabilization. The second has four branches: clarity, joy, etc. The third has five: equanimity, mindfulness, introspection, bliss, and abiding. The last has four: mindfulness, equanimity, neither bliss nor pain, meditative stabilization. The above concentrative absorptions are the results of having meditated on small, medium, and great actual stages of the first concentration, whereby one will be born in the abodes of first concentration, Brahma type, etc. So, chapter 5 finished. So, single body concentration is very important, without which you cannot achieve the higher qualities. So, with reference to the mantra of Harsutra Gati, the first Gati refers to attaining the path of accumulation, of course, which may be attained without attainment of single point of concentration of Buddhism. And then the second Gade refers to about the preparation for which you need to have attained the single body concentration, because in order to reach that the path, you need to have both insight and calm abiding. And in relation to the combined calm abiding and insight, and then the path of seeing referred by Paragate, and then Parasamgate refers to the path of meditation, which is familiarizing with what you have realized. And so in order to build this wisdom, you need to have concentration, and that concentration in turn builds up on the basis of mindfulness, and about mindfulness of your precepts and vows that you have taken. And so regarding myself, even in dreams, I remember I am a monk. And through that, with the help of mindfulness and introspection, you build your concentration, which in turn builds up a single-pointed concentration, and then that in turn builds up powerful wisdom. And so for Buddhist practitioners, concentration, single-pointed concentration is very important. And when I was a child in Tibet, in Nobelanga or Padala, I was doing meditation. So in our text there is mention of starting your meditation practice with short sessions, but more number of times, and then you can extend your session longer and longer. And then there's also the mention of the prescription of the doing for meditation in four sessions in a day. So through familiarization, one can actually develop these. So I have a friend, American friend, who has been meditating for mainly Guhyasamaja Tantra for the last 30 years or so. So he, through his practice, he is able to. This person is able to meditate on the clear light nature of the mind. Of something very close to the clear light nature of the mind, and stay in that meditation single-pointedly for about 3 hours. So he trains his mind from isolation of body, and then the recitation, the Vajra recitation. And recently I met him some time ago, and I told him to meditate on the clarity and nature of the mind. And then there are others who are able to stay in meditation for 3 hours. Amongst Tibetans, there are not many who are able to do this. So there was one Geshe who seemed to have attained calm abiding, the shamatha, single-pointed meditation. So within the context of Tantrayana practice, and one actually develops the single-pointed concentration through the practice of generation stage. So if you are able to stay single-pointedly focused on on whatever you are meditating on for about 3, 4, 5 hours, then that is the measure of having developed a single-pointed concentration. So I have some friends who are able to maintain such single-pointedness of mind. So this is this comes through effort and familiarization. So we have finished chapter 5. Giving a thanksgiving mandala. Mandala kam niyatayami. Do you know? Yes, while I do the concluding ritual of the initiation, say this prayer of the words of truth. Homage to the Triple Gym, magnificent masters of ocean, limitless qualities, those going to bliss in three of the three times your children and your disciples, looking upon the destitute migrants like your only child, please pay attention to my true words of anguish. Expand the doctrine of the completely perfect capable one, which remedies, removes the suffering of cycling existence and solitary peace for abundant, extensive welfare and happiness in Jambudvipa. Increase the 10 kinds of dharma conduct of all those learned and accomplished holders of the doctrine. By pacifying all the unbearable dangers of sickness, weapons, and famine, cause those migrators totally compelled by intolerable strong karma, stricken by the torture of sufferings, without respite, to recover their breath in an ocean of happiness and joy, particularly for all migratory beings in religious snowland or oppressed evil actions by various hordes from the black side to the void of love. May your power of compassion rise and quickly stop the flow of blood and tears. And so, until next year, you have 1 year, until we meet again. And so, have a good heart and dedicate to all the, you think of all the 7 billion people on this earth, and particularly the 6 million Tibetans, and have a good intention to serve others, help others. And in order to be able to do so, you should have both education in both the modern subjects as well as the internal and subject of Buddhism. And if you have a body of, otherwise, if you have a body of a Tibetan, while your mind actually acts like, in your mind, you act like a Westerner, then that's not so good. And so you have to, so we'll have no question and answer session.